Well, welcome to the podcast today. Stu decided I came to the table with a happy story. I came to the table with a very heartwarming, wonderful story about an old man that won the lottery and even won much bigger, and Stu wrecked it.
That's my job is here. Ruin the positive thoughts of others.
The unfortunate part is he's right about all of it. And Laura Logan is with us. You have to hear Laura Logan, respected journalist. Well, respected up until recently. Now I don't know how respected she is. But she's talking about what's happening on the border, and really the best. Everybody who wants to be a journalist should listen to this 5 or 6 minute segment of Laura explaining how you're supposed to do journalism. Miley Cyrus licks a cake, and the whole walrus thing, you know, they're jumping off cliffs, committing suicide because they're so upset about global warming. Apparently not true. Wait until you hear how the Netflix people actually seemingly had a role in pushing these walruses over the cliff. It's amazing. All on today's podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
So just leading the life of luxury, the swinging bachelor. I'm on my way as a swinging bachelor who is married. On my way, driving to the lottery office to pick up my $50,000 check. Now, this is what this guy in North Carolina was doing. He said he went to play Powerball, and his granddaughter had given him a fortune cookie, and on the bottom of the fortune cookie were numbers. So he decided, you know what? I'm going to play those numbers. And so he did. Somehow or another, when he was on his way to pick up what he thought was $50,000, it turns out it was a little more. And as he's looking at the numbers, now he doesn't watch TV, he says, so he doesn't pay attention to any of this. And he saw, as he was driving, he saw the numbers for the Powerball. And he realizes, I think I won more. Now, he didn't know how much. He had no idea. He just played Powerball. He didn't know what the jackpot was, nothing. His granddaughter had just given him some numbers, so he just played it. So he's on the way, and he calls up the office, and he's like, you know what? I think I have all of the numbers. I was coming in to pick up $50,000. I think it might be more. I think I have all of the numbers. And they said, yeah, you do. And he said, wow, how much is it worth? How much is it worth? They said, well, more than $50,000. It's $344 million. Quote, he said, quote, dang, I got them all? I love that. He said he called his wife and said, you ain't going to believe this, but I got it all. Now he says he hopes that the windfalls don't change him. He's going to give $1 million to his brother. I mean, how about something for granddaughter? I mean, she was the one that brought you the cookie. $1 million to his brother to make good on a deal apparently they made. Donate to charities, yada, yada, yada. He took the lump sum of $223 million. He said, I'm still going to wear my jeans, just maybe I'll wear some newer ones. I think it's fantastic.
I don't understand, though. If you win $50,000, I think that, does that mean you've hit five or six,
I don't know
how many numbers you've hit, but you've hit a lot of the numbers, right? Aren't you sitting there staring at that thing 100 times when you've hit for $50,000 to check it, and you miss the fact that you won $300 million?
Well, maybe it was the Powerball number that he didn't check, because he's not a lotto player.
Right.
He wasn't playing it for the Powerball. He just, you know, probably went into a convenience store and put those numbers in and just saw, oh, wow, I got the five right and didn't, I don't know. I don't know how that happens.
Yeah, I don't
but
know
he wasn't playing it, you know, to win the $344 million. He had no idea how much it was worth.
That's incredible.
That's a good day.
It's a type of thing that if I'm working at the lottery, the headquarters, and someone calls me and says, I think I won $50,000, but I'm looking at the numbers. I think I have them all. What I say is, come directly to my desk, and I will give you the $50,000 in exchange for the ticket, and then you need to leave immediately.
Just ask for me.
Yes. Don't go to someone else, because they might do so. You don't know what's going to happen.
It's
very
sketchy around here.
Yeah. And then you take the you give them 50 grand somehow.
I might give them 51.
Yeah, we're giving you a tip.
Yeah. 51. I just want you to know, you're getting a great deal here.
Then he walks out. You turn it in, 344 mil.
Yeah.
That's the way to play that.
I think I'd still take the lump sum, because the officials might be coming to look for me. So I'd take the lump sum. And when I say I, it would be somebody else not related to me that would show up for the check. I'm just saying.
Why do we sit here every time and talk about it as if it's 344 million when it's really 223 million?
Why? Well, it's not even... Wait. It's not even that. It's you can take the 344 over 20 years or whatever.
Right. It's just a silly, we'll give you... First of all, almost everyone takes the lump sum, which there's some question about whether that's a good idea for some people.
I think most people.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some... Because it's always been statistically you should take the 223 million, because it pays off in the long term. But they see the way that people use it, and it's like, maybe you should be guaranteed a payment next year. Maybe that's a good thing. In 19 years, there's still a payment coming in. I think there's a question about that one.
I think if I believed that money and these states and lotteries and everything else would actually stand, then I probably would take it over time. It would be stupid to do it, but I would probably take it over time, because I'd be like, I don't know. I mean, I want something left for my kids. And $250 million. I could see myself going, what? It's only $50 million, five times, six times.
Right. Someone's going to scam you into a real estate investment that doesn't exist.
Right.
Yes. But I mean, they always say this $344 million. It's like, let's be honest about it. It's $223 million. Well, if you want to take it over a very long period of time, you'll get a interest, essentially. Right. But again, you have to also factor in inflation and all those other things. A payment in 20 years... It's a lot different than a payment today.
Well, but let's be real. I mean, why do we say it's $223 million when it's actually about $112?
That's true. Where does he live again?
He lives in North Carolina.
Okay. Yeah, that's not... You're going to lose a lot. You're going to lose...
You lose about half. You have a 40%.
At the end of the day, you're going to lose around half of it, right? And then, of course, every time you spend it, you lose more. And
this is a depressing story now.
It is. Yes,
we've
ruined it.
This story. we had a happy grandfather who had retired.
This guy's life is over, is what I'm saying.
Boy, I'd hate to be you, Jack.
I hope you can buy a nice coffin with it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I tried to start. Look, and he wrecked it. Yeah, okay, let me try this. Okay. Let me try this. Here's a guy that should not win the lottery. Tracy Morgan.
Comedian?
Yes.
Okay.
Who would have thunk that Tracy Morgan would go out and buy a new Bugatti? Okay. But he bought a new Bugatti, and it was $2 million. And he bought it at Bugatti in Manhattan. Now, here's your first...
He's not shopping around for the lower price Bugatti,
right,
apparently.
Right. Now, here's the thing. If you're buying a Bugatti, don't live in Manhattan. What are you going to do? You're going to drive it 3.5 miles an hour?
Right.
In stop-and-go traffic with giant potholes and people, hitting, in the, hey, back up, I've got the right-of-way here. I mean, it's not a pleasant place to be with any car.
It sucks to drive there anyway.
Yeah.
A Bugatti, I can't imagine, especially with that gigantic engine. We're talking 1,000 horsepower in that thing, trying to do a manual shift going around, 44th Street. Like, that's not a good...
It's just ridiculous. Yeah, yeah. It's just ridiculous. Okay, so he was driving his car for about 10 minutes in Manhattan. He just closed your eyes because you know what's coming.
Oh, what did he do?
10 minutes. Nothing. A woman in a late model Honda CRV tried to make a right turn from the left lane and... crashed into his Bugatti and scraped it and grated against the entire side. Okay. He gets out of the car and he's like, what were you thinking? She was like, I don't know. He's like, I've had this car for 10 minutes and it's a Bugatti. Oh, I'm sorry. Looks pretty. What does that mean? A Bugatti? It's a $2 million car.
Oh, my gosh.
So he literally had it for about 30 minutes from the time he drove off the lot and signed the deal, 30 minutes total before she took and just destroyed his Bugatti.
She's got insurance, though, right? I mean, she's got liability insurance. Surely that will cover.
I'm sure that will cover the $1.89 million car.
Oh, God. It's beautiful, too.
Oh, no, it's a convertible. So it's not only, it's used, so you got to expect some dings. It's used, so that's why it was $1.8 million. This was cheap for the Bugatti because it's a convertible, which apparently is very rare.
Very rare, right.
And so he's driving it for the first 10 minutes. I think that's worse than the worst lottery winner. I mean, because that just shows how stupid you are. Don't buy a Bugatti in Manhattan.
Especially if you're Tracy Morgan, who should stay out of all automobiles, right? Like, he was the guy who, he almost died in a massive car crash. Like, why are you even, get it? You should live in the city.
I don't remember that.
Oh, my, yeah, that's his whole, that's the, you know, he was, you know, because he did Saturday Night Live, and he was on 30 Rock, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
he had,
yeah,
like, you know, a bunch of stuff, and he almost got killed. It was in, I think, 2014-ish.
Oh, wow.
And he was almost killed in a giant wreck. It was on the New Jersey Turnpike. And
get out of that area.
Yeah, get leave.
Get out of that area.
Here's an idea. Iowa. Okay? Kansas.
Here's an idea. Subways. If you're going to live there, take a subway.
It's a scary thing when the subway's the safe alternative.
I'm telling you, we lived in New York for a while. The last thing you want is a nice car. What you do is you just go buy a junker. Because I literally saw a car take the bumper, the front bumper, off of a taxi cab at about 65 miles an hour on, I think it was like 42nd Street. And it's just bare. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm walking down the street and I see this car. There's nothing. It's all green lights. And I see this car. It was actually the reverse. It was a car and a taxi cab came up behind it. And this car was just, you know, an out of town person like, I don't know, 42nd Street. I'm trying to find 41st. Where is that? Do I take a left? And so it's just puttering down the street. And this cab comes and it just clips it. It's got to be going 60, 70 miles an hour. And it just clips the front of this car and the bumpers catch on each other and it pulls the bumper off the other car. And so now the bumper is just kind of like spinning in the middle of the road. The guy in the cab didn't even tap on his brakes. That's Manhattan, okay? You buy a crappy car and you park it. And when you come back and it's like burned to the ground and everything is gone, you're like, huh? And you move on.
Right, exactly.
Just move on.
If you go to walk down the street in New York, you'll see those little rubber like things that you put in your trunk and they hang over your bumper because your bumper gets hit randomly so often.
Right.
That people just protect when they park, they put a little piece of rubber just hang over there so hopefully the car bounces off and
doesn't
cause
damage.
You just need like
a Nerf car.
Yeah.
You know, just take a piece of crap and then take a bunch of Nerf footballs and just tape them all around your car, and you have a chance that when you get out of New York, you still have a really crappy car with tape marks where you had all, and that's good. That's a good way to get out of New York with your car.
The best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hi, it's Glenn. If you're a subscriber to the podcast, can you do us a favor and rate us on iTunes? If you're not a subscriber, become one today and listen on your own time. You can subscribe on iTunes. Thanks. Hello, Pat.
Hello, Glenn.
So you are unleashed about?
Well, I was kind of interested in the fact that Lou Dobbs is calling out Republicans for being traitors because they're not supporting Donald Trump's tariffs. And I thought, since when are Republicans traitors for being free trade people?
What time did that monologue happen?
You know, they're cowards and traitors, and they are committing suicide and bringing down the country with them. Well, I mean,
I will say that Lou Dobbs has always been a tariff guy from back in the day. I mean, he was never been a conservative. But he's always been a big tariff guy, going back to his years at CNN.
But he knows for a fact that Republicans have not been tariff.
No, of course. How do you not at least include that in the analysis?
I know.
Right?
I mean, he doesn't. He doesn't. No. He doesn't bake that into anything.
It's been the exact opposite position of every one of these people that's been elected for the past 50 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, obviously the pro-union left has been the ones asking for tariffs all this time. Mm-hmm. So they're talking, they say now the tariffs as requested by Trump, if implemented, and again, we hope this is a...
Which ones? The Mexican?
The Mexican ones. Okay. Just the Mexican ones, if implemented. And we hope it's a negotiation. We know how this stuff works because, you know, Trump threatens these things and hopefully they don't come to pass. But if they do, it would be the largest tax increase in 35 years.
Wow. Really?
That's a big number.
Yeah, it is.
Now, of course, that's on top of other tariffs. In addition, it's on top of a big tax cut, right? So it doesn't mean that when he started to when we would be here, would be the biggest tax increase. But from where we are right now to the end of these Mexican tariffs would be the biggest tax increase in 35 years. And I just don't, I don't know why, you know, again, like this is, I know something he believes and it's something that, you know, conservatives have disagreed with the entire time I've been alive.
But until now,
that they have all fallen apart. I mean, the arguments have completely fallen apart. We won that one. Even the Democrats were against tariffs. You know, I mean, it was old think. And you know, I'm happy to see. First of all, aren't tariffs something that the president needs the Senate for?
No, I mean, tariffs. So he's going to do it. The way he's going to do this is interesting. And one another reason why it's going to be a problem. He's basically going to have to do another emergency declaration to get the tariffs through. Now, we know we had an issue with the last one, and a lot of our listeners did as well. And that, like, we really think the border is a big deal. We really want the wall. But, like, is this the right way to do it? Yeah. If you remember, a bunch of Republicans voted against him on that, just not enough to get to override the veto. Here, you have a serious issue where apparently in the meeting, there were no senators on Trump's side in the meeting when it came to the tariffs.
And this is something that should go through Congress, but he's trying to circumvent that process again.
Well, sort of. I mean, because, again, like trade authority in the Constitution is Congress.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be through Congress. Right. Congress gave a lot of this authority to the president. However, the president has to justify it. So to justify it, his approach here is going to likely be, and we don't know for sure, he hasn't released this certainty, but this is what the White House sources are saying, is that he would have to go through another emergency declaration, which would either be amending the one that already exists or creating a brand new emergency declaration. So again, the Congress would have a chance to override it. There is no evidence that Republicans would stand up to him to the numbers to get to 67 votes. And this also includes the House would have to also get to 2/3. There's no evidence on any issue
that they would stand up to Trump.
So, I mean, like they most of this is them just talking a big game. They want to say they're trying to hopefully influence Trump before these things go into effect. Maybe they can move him. Maybe they can delay them. These are the games that they play. In reality, is the Republican Congress going to overturn a veto from Donald Trump on anything? I think
the answer to that is no.
I don't,
especially not
they all now. Talk a big game, but they're not going to do that. And, like, you know, a lot of the stuff they shouldn't be overturning. Trump's done a lot of really good things. This one in particular, though, has been against the philosophy of the party for at least 50 years. So
the problem is that you Donald Trump is under such attack right now and has been the whole time that anything that even sounds like you're against him, you're immediately tossed to the side.
Yeah,
that's true.
You know, I came out for Justin Amash just to say I think he's a good guy and I think he believes in the Constitution.
Which is all true, by the way.
I'm against impeachment and what he said about impeachment, and I'm against him running in 2020. That doesn't seem to matter.
No.
Not to Breitbart or anybody else. They're just saying, oh, Glenn Beck wants impeachment. No. No,
are you on the Trump train or not?
Well,
maybe
I'm not on anybody's train.
Justin Amash is a solid conservative. Yeah. He's a solid conservative.
He has his problems. He has some things that I disagree with. You know, when it comes to Israel, et cetera, et cetera. I disagree with those things, but I'm fine with that. We should disagree with things. I mean, we can't. You'll never be in lockstep with everybody. But that doesn't mean.
But he's got 100% rating from FreedomWorks.
Yeah,
100%.
I know.
Yeah.
So to throw, we can't throw people away like this. We can't throw people away. We're eating our own, and we're seeing this happen now. Do you see how they are just coming after Joe Biden?
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Today there was a bunch of news stories about it.
Plagiarism, and he's lying about the civil rights marching all of that.
There was the editorial that came out about how, you know, we need a JFK. We need a younger guy with vision. This is, we don't need another Hillary Clinton. I mean, they are coming after him.
They also dug up when he was 29 years old and running, that he used all these attacks against
about
his opponent,
old people.
How old he was.
Yeah.
Like you know, they're like, my opponent was fighting polio. I'm fighting, you know, like he's like, it's totally ridiculous. And he wound up winning the race by, I think, 3,000 votes. It was a very close race. But yeah, look, you expect a field of 24. They realize he's ahead. The latest polls have his lead shrinking a little bit. So it'll be interesting to see if any of this stuff
32 works. 32-18 is the last one I've seen.
Still a nice big lead.
Still.
He's still
14 points.
It's his to lose, right?
Yes.
If he was a great candidate, then.
Which he's not.
He's a terrible candidate. And he loses, you know, I mean, he's lost every time he's tried to run for president and really been buried. You know, the other two times.
Yeah.
If he has a chance, I mean, this is his chance to win. He walks in here with a massive lead. He's got a field of 24 people, 17 of which are at 0 or 1%. So, I mean, there is not a lot, like the field feels really big, but there's not a lot of competitors there.
Even when he came out for their pet project, the climate change stuff yesterday, they bashed him on that because that was plagiarized. He didn't give credit to the person who wrote that bill. Did AOC have to put up with that when she released Green New Deal?
But they don't believe him on that. They want a hardcore socialist.
Yeah, they do.
You know, they want.
Yes,
did you see what AOC said yesterday
about
your right to a profit?
Yeah, yeah.
That it's not a right. Before your privilege of profit comes the right to everyone having a decent house.
She's frightening.
She's terrifying. But the people, you know, behind her are the same people behind Bernie Sanders, and they're the same people behind, you know, pretty much all of them, except for Joe Biden.
And Biden, I read a very sad article the other day about how the relationship between Biden and Obama, and that, like, Obama apparently, you know, encouraged him pretty strongly not to run in 2016. Because they, you know, it was Hillary's thing and she's the one that's going to do this and blah, blah, blah. So their team really came at him. And of course, he was going through the death of his son. So he found a way to not run, essentially. Mm-hmm. And of course, like, you know,
and
who
regretted
knows?
It.
Yeah. Who knows what would have happened, obviously.
Yeah.
Now there's been these conversations. You know, you have people, a lot of the Obama people have moved on to other campaigns. They're working for other candidates. Obama is not coming out and endorsing anyone. He's just kind of hanging back, and he has helped, and this is a big thing. He did give the 2012 email list to Joe Biden, which is huge. I mean, as far as fundraising and everything else. So it's not like there's been no cooperation, but like there's just
But he's not supporting him.
Yeah, it's sad.
Other than the email list, because
Obama is looked at as,
well, I don't think he wants
almost,
to either.
I don't think so either, but he's looked at on the left as almost a Glenn Beck. Now, he is not fashionable with them at all.
No.
He is not the guy who they look at him as like, you were kind of a traitor.
Like, I use yourself as someone who's unfashionable. No, but I mean, look, Biden's still winning the primary. So, I mean, it's not that unfashionable.
But did you see when?
I'm saying Barack Obama. That Barack Obama is out of fashion with the left.
Right,
he's no longer.
Because he's not a socialist. Well, although I think
he is.
He has those tendencies.
He had the opportunity. He wasn't a revolutionary.
Yeah.
But he's got a big, yeah. I mean, you think about what is of picking a vice president. It is a one-person presidential election. Barack Obama got to select essentially his successor, right? If something happens to him, who's the one person in the United States I want to be president? He picked Joe Biden. Now he's not endorsing Joe Biden.
It's pretty
like,
weird.
It is, it's amazing, right?
And do you guys see when they asked him about that, when they asked Biden, why isn't Barack Obama endorsing you? I didn't want him to.
Yeah,
I asked him not to.
Yeah.
And then he said, and besides, he didn't. And then he stopped himself.
Offer.
But he didn't want to endorse me. Yeah. But I told him, no, I don't want your endorsement. Look, I want to give the rest of these kids a fighting chance. And that would just make it too unfair.
That's ridiculous.
It's asinine.
And it is ridiculous from Obama. Obama should be endorsing him.
Yeah,
He told us. He stood in front of the American people and said, hey, if I get sick, if I get injured, if
he can
someone,
keep his doctor?
No, not that.
Oh, okay.
You cannot keep your doctor. But right. you can keep Joe Biden. If I have to leave office for whatever reason, the one person who should lead this country is Joe Biden.
But I don't think anybody listened to that. Because if that was it, if I get sick, he followed it with, I can keep my doctor. If I get sick, you can keep Joe Biden. We wouldn't have Obamacare today if that was the promise.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hey, it's Glenn, and if you like what you hear on the program, you should check out Pat Gray Unleashed. His podcast is available wherever you download your favorite podcast. Journalist and a profile in courage, Laura Logan, joins us now. Laura, nice to meet you and nice to have you on the program.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's get right into what you're doing recently, and then I'd like to kind of open it up to more broad on the media and what to expect and what we can do to change things. But you've been down on our border, and strangely, you have a different report than what the mainstream media is giving everyone.
Well, you know, to be honest, I don't watch what the mainstream media is giving everybody, especially when I'm working, right? Because my job is, well, I'm focused on doing my job.
Yeah.
I'm not too worried about what other people are doing. And a wise old correspondent told me many years ago that he, you know, every day he goes out and he does his best and he doesn't worry about his competition. And some days he's the best and some days he's not. So, but it's not surprising to me that it's different because I know where I go, people all the time along the border in all different capacities keep saying, nobody is telling our story. Mm-hmm. Nobody is talking about this. Nobody's telling the truth of, you know, it's not that people are lying about the border. It's not that it's just that there's more than one story. The only story is not simply a story of, you know, of poor people who want to move mm-hmm. to the United States to improve their lives. That is one part of the story, and it's a very important part of the story. And I can honestly tell you, I've had moments where, you know, I've been climbing into my pretty crappy bed in my pretty crappy hotel at night. And I've just about wanted to cry thinking about the people who don't even know, you know, the people I've seen with their children and all the rest of it. I mean, I've got a big heart and that breaks my heart,
mm-hmm.
but it's only one part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, my job as a reporter has always been to understand the full context and cover as much of the story as I can. And that's all I'm trying to do.
So there are the sins of omission, and I think that's what people are committing by saying that this is the only part of the story. And you're right. I've been down at the border myself, and you know we raised money to bring, you know, food and comfort down to some of the children that were there during the Obama administration. I tried to get the media to pay attention to the cages.
Oh, you're not allowed to talk about that, Ken.
I know. But it doesn't happen, and it shows this real bias, and I don't want to dwell on this.
I've got one word for you. I have actually spoken to people down there right across law enforcement and Border Patrol who actually talk about when in a certain point in the Obama administration, when they no longer wanted to deal with the deporter-in-chief title and the problem of all the children that they had in detention, basically in prison, that some people like to so-called that cages. What did they do? Actually, Border Patrol agents then had orders where they would have to intercept people who they found coming over the border in certain parts, and they would have to escort them back down to the border and send them back. Don't apprehend them. Don't create a statistic. Don't create a problem for us. Let's just push you over the border then and pretend that this is not happening. I can't say how widespread that was. I can't say that it was everywhere, but I can tell you that it did happen, and more than once.
So what is it that people are saying, nobody's telling this story? What are the important stories that we're not hearing?
Well, first and foremost, what people just leave out of the narrative is that this is almost like a theater. It's a performance, not for the people who are living it, because they are like their pawns. It's a theater for the cartels. Yes, they make an enormous amount of money out of all the people that cross because they take most of the smuggling fees. They don't run the smuggling operations. They're way too smart for that. They have professional human smuggling operations, human trafficking organizations that are global who do the smuggling for them. But they pay an enormous amount of what they earn. They pay that to the cartels. The Mexican cartels decide who crosses, where they cross, when they cross. And so if you imagine you're a pilot and you can see the whole border from the air, that's really how the cartels operate. You know, it's divided up into the three main cartels now, the Sinaloa cartel, the Gulf cartel, and what used to be called the Zetas. That's now Cartel del Nostre. But those are the three main cartels that control the traffic. And the reason you have people coming in all these difficult places, one of the reasons, a big reason, is that the cartels know if they split the resources of Border Patrol, if you've got a group of 5 people or a group of 10 people and they all run in different directions, how many agents does it now take to stop them? You know, so that's exactly what they're doing. They're splitting the resources. Pilots have described to me, for example, in parts of the border, seeing groups of anywhere between 50 and 200 crossing at exactly the same time at the crossing points, sort of, you know, 100 yards from each other, right? So imagine in 5 different places separated by 100 yards, and you have hundreds of people. So what does that do? In one tiny little town on the border in Texas, on the Rio Grande Valley, they have Border Patrol facilities that are built to house a maximum of 116 people. Last weekend, they had over 1,100. Over 1,100 in one weekend, and they have people every single day. And that's just one weekend. This has been going on for months and months and months. So in these places where people get, people get told all the time, Texans, for example, Texans are a bunch of racist rednecks, right? And Texans don't care about people. Look, they don't recognize the children of illegal immigrants born in this country. Look at all the evil things people in Texas do. They put illegal immigrants under bridges in terrible weather to suffer. Well, literally, you've got Border Patrol agents looking at me with desperation saying, we don't know where else to put people. You've got churches in El Paso who the NGOs have run out of capacity, right? The NGOs that come from New York and other parts of the country that like to do interviews in the paper sometimes about everything they're doing down on the border, except they've run out of capacity. And it's the local people in many of these places who are trying to bear, you know, to help in some ways. And the other, you know, there's another really important thing that gets left out of the narrative, which is that the large majority of Border Patrol agents are Hispanic Americans or Mexican Americans or whatever you want to call them. They're not, you know, it's not just these evil white men who are trying to stop people coming into this country. It's not that at all. In fact, it's much more complex. And in some of these towns, the vast majority of the people who live there are Hispanic American. And you know, Texas itself has a history that's very much wrapped up in Mexico. And the first president of Texas was Mexican. And when you look at the history here, these two people, I'm not painting a picture of nirvana. There's always issues between people, but it's very different to what people say it is from a distance. It's the reality is not much like that at all. And I have yet to meet anyone who wants these people to suffer or who is deliberately cruel to people. And, you know, my experience is limited to my experience, you know.
I will tell you this. When you say these people are pawns, they are. They're being, I feel horrible for them. Because in some cases, not all cases, but in many cases, I think if I were on the other side of the border and I saw that America really didn't care about its borders and they were going to give away free citizenship and I could get my family there, and my family doesn't, we're living in a town that maybe has violence but doesn't have any real chance for my kids, you're damn right I'd be over here. I would absolutely do it because I would think that America didn't really care and they were offering citizenship. So take that chance for my children to be able to have a better life. That they are, those people are being preyed on by all these different groups that have all different agendas, including the drug cartels that are holding back some family members and saying, look, we're going to sell you this and we'll bring them over. You do us a favor. We'll do you a favor. And then we'll send your relative over. And I mean, we're importing people and enslaving people to some of these drug cartels.
Oh, no, we're doing the bidding of the drug cartels. Yes. Whether wittingly or unwittingly, that's happening. And I can tell you, I can add to what you're saying, Glenn. How about if you were watching or listening to commercials on the radio, which tell you, go to America, you're going to get a house, you're going to get land, you're going to get a job, you're going to get this or that. And then add to that the fact that, you know, I mean, one of my most trusted, the person that I respect most in the world, my producer, Max McClellan, he went and did a story in a series of reports in Honduras. He was actually with a family when they said goodbye to their 15-year-old daughter and sent her to a better life in America. And you can imagine, right? I mean, he's a dad. He's got a daughter. I have two daughters and a son. I mean, what could be more heartbreaking than that? I mean, it's really painful for me to even imagine being in that situation. But they don't even know if their daughter is actually going to a real job in America.
There's so much sex trafficking. And you imagine sending your 15-year-old daughter into...
Nobody does that unless they are absolutely desperate or they have no other options, right? Nobody. I mean, the family, the mother was sobbing, the father was crying, the daughter was crying. You can imagine. That's a very painful thing. So, but her chance, she has a significant chance of being raped along the way.
Oh, yeah.
When people come from Latin America, they get to the first stash house inside of Mexico. People get raped at the stash houses. And then there's another stash house. You know, there's other stash houses all along the way, but right on the Mexican side, close to the border, and then more stash houses when you cross the border. And I've been looking at doing stories on this. We have reports of different people who get raped at every one of those locations along the way. And then, you know, but we're still trying to find someone who has been through that to talk about it, because these things are very difficult to cover.
Yes.
And also because, you know, it's very easy to tear these stories apart. This is, here, I have one for you. This is the only time in my career as a journalist, a professional, where I have looked at the statistics of rape and sexual abuse, right? Trying to figure out, okay, how prevalent is this? What exactly are the facts? What is the chance when you get on that journey that this is going to happen to you? How bad is it? Truly, right? And in this case, this is one case where the media, by and large, says, oh, you can't prove that this is happening. Oh, you know, yes, there was this MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, the NGO, they did a big study on it, and they found that, you know, at least 30% of the women making this journey get raped or sexually assaulted. But what do you have many journalists turning around and saying then? Well, they took a sample of people on their way to the U.S. in Mexico. They didn't, you know, take everybody, and they didn't take everybody from every different country. And so you get 15 reasons why the MSF statistic is not representative. Well, you know, isn't the standard, the way we normally in the media treat rape and sexual assault figures, is we always say it's the most underreported crime, don't we? Doesn't that sound familiar?
Yep.
And it's just it's a small irony that I noticed when I was researching this story. Yeah. I thought, wow, all my professional life, you know, wherever I've been, people have said that there's, you know, if that's the official figure, you can bet it's going to be much more than that.
Yes.
Now here you have people actually defending human traffickers, defending cartels, defending coyotes who rape people, and saying, well, you know, it's we can't trust that figure because it's not fully representative.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program. Like listening to this podcast? If you're not a subscriber, become one now on iTunes. And while you're there, do us a favor and rate the show.
So I don't know if you've seen Netflix, their series Our Planet. It's documentary, and it's David Attenborough, blah, blah, blah. And everybody thinks, oh, it's beautiful, and it's got all kinds of great information in it. Oh, my gosh, these walruses are committing suicide. There is a researcher, a zoologist with 35 years of experience, especially on Arctic animals, she said, no, this is just Netflix and their tragedy porn, the climate hoax. I don't know if you can put your kids in front of Our Planet and just say, oh, yeah, watch this. It's great, because it's full of nonsense. And they're saying these walruses are, you know, falling to their death because they're starving to death and there's no ice. And it's very sad. It's awful to watch. But she said that's not what's happening. And Susan is with us now. Hello, Susan. How are you?
I'm just fine. Thanks. Good morning.
So tell me about the walruses that are, I mean, just plunging to their death because there's no ice.
Well, in fact, the haulouts of walrus, these are mostly mothers with their calves on these Arctic beaches. They're really natural events that are not caused by lack of sea ice. They've always happened. And the herds come onto the shore in large numbers because the walruses are more abundant now than they were even 50 years ago.
Okay, so they have they're like a boom and bust society, aren't they? When go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that they have a tendency to, the population builds higher and higher. They outstrip their food supply, and then animals starve and the population goes down until the food supply can rebuild. And mostly they're eating clams and things like that that live on the bottom of the ocean.
So what is this haul out? What does that mean, the haul out?
Well, walruses are herd animals. They really like to stick together. And in fact, they really prefer to be tightly packed. And so they group together. The haul out just means grouping together. And so when there's sea ice available, they will haul out on the ice in fairly large groups. And at other times, they will haul out on beaches. But they don't. They have been hauling out on beaches since the 1800s. There's been records going back of those haulouts, both on the coast of Russia near the Bering Sea and also on the coast of Alaska. So this is a behavior that's quite natural for them, and it really isn't sea ice dependent. It's something that happens in the late summer and fall on a fairly regular basis.
And so they've been doing this since we've started noticing them and recording them. And they go up onto the beach or onto the rocks, and they're all tightly packed in. And is it just kind of like a whole bunch of, you know, puppies on a bed, and, you know, somebody moves and another person moves and one of the puppies would fall off the bed? I mean, they're not committing suicide, and they're just so packed tightly that, is that what's happening?
Exactly. And the other thing is that they're also quite easily spooked at that point in time, because these are mostly mothers with their calves. They're very protective. And if one of the animals at the back of the pack, sort of on the beach side, gets frightened and starts heading for the water, because that's their natural instinct when they're frightened, then they sort of push the herd ahead of them. And in fact, hundreds of animals can be trampled even along a flat beach. But if they've managed to get themselves up onto a high cliff, then there's no alternative but to fall over the edge. And it's not only certain that that's what happened in the Netflix video, but we know from reports that were issued in the newspaper that there was an polar bears had actually spooked walruses off the same cliff that was filmed in that video 2 days before it was filmed.
So wait a minute. Because in that film, it shows all these walruses down at the bottom of the pile of rocks. And you think, oh my gosh, they're just all dying. And I wish there was just an ice slope there to just gently push them back in the water. But you're saying not only is it normal and natural for them to go up on the rocks and then have no place to go but over the cliff, but you're saying that that big pile was also partly caused by polar bears and them up at the top of the cliff going, oh, crap, oh, crap, oh, crap, and backing up over the cliff?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, my gosh.
And because we know that there was this incident that was initiated by polar bears that happened just 2 days before, we know that most of those animals that were filmed, the carcasses laying along the beach, almost certainly happened from the polar bear spooked incident. And what we think happened was that there were members from World Wildlife Foundation or the WWF who were on site at the time, and part of the whole Netflix team called the film crew in to come and film the walruses that were still up on the cliff.
Oh my gosh.
And so it was really a whole contrived setup. And in looking at what was happening, we know that there were still polar bears in the area. I've seen the film. In fact, the closing shot shows a polar bear coming out of the water onto the beach to feed on the walruses, the dead walruses. But when you're looking at how the whole footage was shot, there's a cameraman positioned just about at the place where the walruses could have come safely down from the cliff, but that way was blocked. And if there were still polar bears in the area, they could have been coming up from on the backside of the cliff, or at least the walruses could have smelled them. Even that would have set them off. What we also know is that some of the shots in the film had to have been taken with a drone. Now, even a drone flying overhead could also have spooked them. So we've got a situation where the filmmakers themselves,
this is unbelievable,
could have been complicit in generating at least the walruses that they filmed. And then they attributed all of that to a lack of sea ice, blamed on climate change.
So how much of these series, because my son watches them, my daughter watches them, I've watched them, and there's times when I've rolled my eyes and gone, okay, I didn't know all this about the walruses. How much of these things can we even sit down and let our kids watch and trust that it's true?
Well, I think really what the only thing that you can do is let your kids watch it. I mean, it's beautiful photography.
That's beautiful.
There's no doubt that it actually is. Parts of it are true. I mean, the haulouts are true. But you have to take the commentary with a grain of salt. But you also have to be prepared ahead of time to talk to your kids about the fact that everything that is said there might not be true. And hey, maybe we should follow up and look into this, and they've said that this is why this happened. Let's go and look up to see, you know, what the background information is on that. And I think that if parents are prepared to follow up with their kids and to look into that, it makes it a learning experience.
Susan, I got to tell you, they don't have access to a zoologist like you, like I do, and you go online, I'm sure WWF and all of these global warming institutions have rushed to put things out that say it is true. I mean, how do you know what's true? How do you know what a trusted source is on actual science anymore?
No, well, that is true, for sure. And but what you can do, I mean, it's one of the reasons that I've been blogging about polar bears since 2012, and that's to actually make sure that the information is up there for people to find on the internet. Now, people might say, well, how do I trust you? However, what I do is make sure that I list the sources where I get my information from so that people can follow it up. But at the very least, when there's information like that available, you can say, oh, okay, well, there's two sides to this story. This person's saying this, this person's saying that. Then maybe I have to leave that any interpretation up in the air and just say that it can't, none of it can be trusted. And that's really an awful place for science to be in.
Okay, Susan, thank you so much for being on with us. We really appreciate your time. Her name is Susan Crockford. She is a zoologist and author of the book, The Polar Bear Catastrophe That Never Happened. You can read her article, Netflix is Lying About Those Falling Walruses, at the Financial Post. And her website is polarbearscience.com. That's polarbearscience.com.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.